Hi, I'm Graham Aubrey. You're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance FM.
Oh, do you want to like Marks and Spencer's go?
You're listening to... You're listening to Resonance FM. Because you're with it. Because you're with it. No. I've taken it too far now.
Taken it too far.
That's not me. Imagine me what I'm like when I drink beer.
This is The Bike Show on Resonance 104.4 FM. My name's Jack Thurston. Welcome to a new season of the show. And of course, since the very earliest days of the bicycle, adventurous cyclists have been unable to resist the allure of the mountains, the challenge of riding up and the thrill of freewheeling down the other side. And of course, there's the scenery. From the deep and eerie rocky gorges to breathtaking vistas from high mountain tops, and the splendour of glaciers, waterfalls, meadows and forests. Mountains have also been the crucible of many of the most dramatic moments in professional bike racing. For more than 100 years, the Tour de France has been paying its annual visits to the Alps and the Pyrenees, while the race organisers of the Giro d'Italia have made a name for themselves, seeking out the precipitous climbs of Italy. Last month, our very own Tour of Britain held its first ever summit finish, with a stage ending beneath Hator Rocks on Dartmoor. More of a hill than a mountain, but it's the thought that counts. Here with me in the studio at Resonance FM to talk about the great mountains of cycling are author Daniel Freeb and photographer Pete Godding, authors together of Mountain High, the best-selling book about the iconic climbs of cycle sport. And now they've got a sequel, Mountain Higher, which offers the same blend of lyrical prose, practical information and mouth-watering photography. Welcome both to The Bike Show. Here with me to talk about the great mountains of cycling are author Daniel Freeb and photographer Pete Godding, authors of Mountain High, the best-selling book about the iconic climbs of cycle sport. And they've now put out a sequel, Mountain Higher, which offers the same blend of lyrical prose, practical information and mouth-watering photography. Welcome both to The Bike Show.
Hi, Jack.
Hello.
So how did you go about coming up with a sequel to a book that is all about presenting the biggest and the best mountain climbs? How do you go one better than Mountain High?
I mean, I think, Jack, when we did the first one, we were very tied to the sort of legendary climbs. There's a real tick list, I think, in every cycling aficionado, cycle rider's head. Of the Tourmalet, the Ventoux, they're names that we know pretty well. You know, we threw in a few fairly offbeat ones, but obviously this is a subject we're passionate about. And also during the course of the research for the first book, you know, our kind of frustration grew about not being able to, you know, venture further afield, include... also climbs that aren't besieged by cyclotourists every Saturday in summer, which a lot of these climbs, the most famous climbs, the likes of Alpe d'Huez and the Galibier, you know, you'll find thousands of...
For which you share a little bit of the responsibility.
Yeah, well, it's true, which is, you know, which is great in itself, but, you know, I came into cycling in the mountains from the point of view of you know, the adventure that is available in the mountains, the solitude, the tranquility, and I really like to, you know, ride a mountain kind of in total isolation and to be able to really soak in everything around me. And I know other people are different. Other people do enjoy, you know, cyclosportives, grand fondos, et cetera, but, yeah, we wanted to give something somewhere where people can find that isolation.
Because, Pete, you spend a lot of your time photographing bike races, but here there's
not a single... Well, there is a cyclist on the front cover. Although it looks like they're sort of painted in. Something's happened to that photo to give it a kind of otherworldly look about it. But inside the book, you really give pride of place to the roads and you kind of hard to actually take pictures that don't include anyone riding a bike up the hill.
Yeah, we made a concerted effort, especially in the second book, but in the first book as well, to try and remove every cyclist, every car, anything that would look like there's somebody else on the road. Because of this personal experience, we wanted to try and achieve the sort of tranquility, when you go up a mountain, or personally for me and for Daniel, I think, as well, we do prefer that there is no one else around. You want to enjoy it as you are the only person on top of the world in some ways. So this is how I try to portray it in my photos as well. So,
and this being a book of little known climbs, that's presumably a much harder research job than the famous climbs of cycle sport. How did you go about tracking down these unknown climbs?
Yeah, it was difficult, Jack, because we had several criteria that we wanted to sort of work on. One was the kind of extremist sort of difficulty of the of some of the climbs. This is a trend, obviously, not only in amateur cycling, but in professional cycling, to search out ever steeper, ever harder mountains to climb. So that was one thing we wanted to look at. Another one was obviously kind of undiscovered climbs that are conspicuously not famous. They've not been included in major races, etc. And others were just places which were simply breathtaking in terms of the landscape and very, very memorable. And how did we go about that? We asked a lot of people. There was a kind of leftover list from the first book that we wanted to include but weren't able to. And I mean, a very, very valuable resource for me when I was picking the climbs. And I should state that the long list was absolutely huge, hundreds. And actually, in the book itself, we probably do mention 200-300 climbs at various points, trying to weave them in connection with the other ones. But we whittled it down largely thanks to advice I got from the communities that exist of people who are passionate about the same thing as us going and searching out these little known mountains.
And so did you go and ride every mountain? Obviously, Pete, you had to go and photograph every mountain. Yeah. Did you ride every mountain, Daniel? Because you're a bike rider.
Yeah, I'm not much of a bike rider anymore, but yeah, that was a vital part of the research, riding the climbs, although I don't really talk about that in the book. I sort of figured that was another thing we've never wanted to do with either of the books. We never really wanted to talk about our own personal experience of going to these destinations. We wanted to preserve the mystique, and we felt that by talking about ourselves, that was kind of demystifying.
Yeah, and putting cyclists in the photographs as well, I think that takes away the mystique of the experience, the personal experience that we're trying to portray as well. It pretty much comes across, and hopefully we manage to show that in the sort of awe-inspiring scenery that we put on the page.
So you mentioned that there was a very long list. Mm. Did you have any battles between you, with Daniel with a great story that you wanted to tell, and Pete with the most heartbreakingly beautiful photograph? And are there any climbs that didn't make it in that that you think, oh dear, that should have been in?
Yeah, one that springs to mind, Mont Aigual, which is in the massive Central, which I attempted three times. To be fair, Daniel was adamant that this had to go in. And to be fair, it was an amazing that outcrop of mountains there is something that unfortunately, sadly, isn't in this book this time anyway. But yeah, the first time I turned up, I sat at the top and I was just shrouded in mist, so I couldn't even see a meter in front of me. And then the second time, I think I was up the road and the weather report was just terrible, so I couldn't even go up the road, and I didn't even attempt it. To be fair, the third time I went there, because of this late winter we had in 2013, basically the snow was above my head with about 2 kilometres to the summit of the mountain, and I just couldn't shoot. I got some amazing shots of snow-covered mountains and roads, but it was impassable to my car even. I had to sort of straddle a road-clearing, snow-clearing car in front of me, and even then, I had to give up a kilometre before the summit because Literally, you were swimming through the snow. So, yeah, that one unfortunately hit the...
That was one that got away.
Yeah, unfortunately. Although they are lovely pictures, and I think I'll do something with them one day, but it just doesn't fit in with this book particularly.
Maybe for a snowboarding book or something.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, that was one that I really wanted to include, purely because we wanted to include all of the main ranges, really, well, particularly in countries like France and Italy, where, you know, people tend to go on cycling holidays, and you know, so that was we wanted the Cevennes, we wanted the Pyrenees, the Vosges, etc. When you start to add up all these ranges, and especially in places like Spain, all the different Sierras, and it becomes impossible. There are so many.
We wanted to broaden our horizons a little bit compared to the first book, where we centred on probably France, Spain, and Italy on the most. And this time we went to places like Poland, Czech Republic. And many other countries that weren't in the first book. So hopefully we've been a bit more all-encompassing this time.
Well, let's have a little bit of a musical interlude and come back to talk about more of the undiscovered cycle climbs of Europe. This is Loretta Lynn.
Simple and real, 'cause up on the ridge, folks, that's the deal. Well, my daddy worked down in the dark coal mines, shoveling that coal on a shovel at a time. Never made a lot of money, didn't have much, but we're high on life and rich in love. High on a mountaintop, we live, we love, and we laugh a lot. Folks up here know what they've got. High on a mountaintop, of the world like a little bitty spot. I ain't coming down, no, never, I'm not. High on a mountain top, high on a mountain top. Well, down in the holler lived my Uncle Joe. He pulled out his fiddle and rosin his bow. We're all singing dance and we ain't gonna stop. And the moonshine flows behind every rock. High on a mountain top, we live, we love, and we laugh a lot. Folks up here know what they got. Up here, folks, heaven's not that far. High on a mountain top, we live, we love, and we laugh a lot. Folks up here know what they've got. High on a mountain top, high on a mountain top, where the rest of the world's like a little bitty spot. I ain't coming down, no, never, I'm not. High on a mountain top, high on a mountain top.
That's Loretta Lynn, High on a Mountain Top. You're listening to The Bike Show here on Resonance FM. We're talking about cycling up mountains. Daniel and Pete, we're in something of a bike book publishing boom right now, which is good news for all of us who write books about cycling. And there are plenty of books about mountain climbs that are coming out. Simon Warren's Pocket Guides, which are terrific, and obviously yours and a few others which I won't mention. But it's quite interesting that it is actually a long tradition of writing about cycling up mountains, writing about going up mountains, and it has its roots more in cycle touring than in cycle sport, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I was absolutely astonished when I was researching the book to come across a guide on cycling in the Alps written by a guy called Charles Freeston at the start of the 20th century. And this is actually I don't really want to give away the secret, but this is available online. You can, I think you can download it for free if you look in the right places.
Yeah, I think it's on archive.org, isn't
it? That's correct, yeah. And it's quite ambiguous when you read it how he's actually tackling them, whether he's pushing his bike to the top and just coasting, as he calls it, I think coasting down, which is, I think, what he was doing. But he was going over some pretty serious passes on some pretty nasty, rutted roads.
On quite a heavy bike.
Yeah, I imagine so.
I mean, it must have been extraordinary to be writing a book like that in the 1890s, researching. I mean, can you even comprehend how you'd go about doing that?
No, and some of the... I mean, I was sort of enchanted by some of the vocabulary used. I mean, obviously, this was completely new territory that he was literally and figuratively that he was venturing into. And, you know, didn't talk about cyclists, talked about wheelmen. And like I said, he didn't talk about descending. It was all coasting and... a lot of it is quite sort of alien sounding to us now, but yeah, and it's interesting to look at the sort of attitude to cycling in the mountains at the start of the 20th century. Obviously, there are the famous, very famous incidents when the Tour de France first started to venture into the mountains. The famous diatribe from Octave Lapize in the Tour de France, he called the Tour de France organisers murderers. And you know, now, like you said, Jack, it's really very sort of universal. It's very commonplace. I think you know, most amateur cyclists have at some point been to the mountains and taken on some of these huge passes.
Well, if you'll indulge me for a moment, I'd like to read out a short passage, an extract from an account by the London Bicycle Club, a small group, I think five members of this club, who rode the Circle of Death, which is the Tourmalet, the Aubisque,
the Aspin, the Perisort.
Yeah, they went down there. They rode down from London, and it would have been on their high wheelers. So this is the penny farthing style of bicycle. And this was in 1879.
Wow.
And the 19th of September, and they've spent the night at the blacksmith's at Luce Saint-Sauveur, isn't it? This is what the account says. Soon after 8, the party rode out. A kilometre or two gone, they were forced to walk for the rest of the way, rising 1,674 feet up to Barège, the road, though a good wide one, being steep and extremely muddy from the heavy rain during the night. Such steep, short zigzags as we have nowhere else seen, quite a labour, in fact, to get the machines up them. The trudge up for 6¾ miles more, rising during that time 2,878 feet, proved a great grind, especially towards the top, as the road, a carriage one, being composed of small shale, was naturally very sticky from frequent moisture. It was a dreary walk, mostly bare rock and shale around. As we were in the clouds nearly all the time, we saw very little of the surrounding peaks and no views to speak of. Some distance up, we lunched on rolls, chocolate and ice cream. Arrived soon after 2 at the top of the Col du Tourmalet, in a small cutting at a height of 6,962 feet above sea level, with a cold drizzle falling. The London Bicycle Club call having been duly sounded, songs sung, and pipes with difficulty lit, the descent was commenced. Soon after, we had a fine view of the rugged Pic du Midi de Bigorre close by, and past old patches of dirty snow. Although still sticky and pretty steep, Hutchings managed with his strap brake to ride down to grip and, of course, arrived long before the rest. Good old Hutchings with his strap brake. What is a strap brake?
No idea.
No idea.
I mean, that's how it was in 1879.
That's crazy. I did a feature for Pro Cycling magazine with a colleague, an old colleague of ours, Pete Cousins, and he rode, it's a bit later, I think it's 1930s, Victor Fontaine. He had a bike which had wooden rim wheels and alike, and a single speed bicycle going up the Tourmalet, and my colleague Pete, bless him, he did a couple of kilometres. He really did well doing a couple of kilometres, but it was just the most painful thing you could ever think of. These bikes were not made to do these things, really, but they definitely made
but those early riders you mentioned, Octave Lapize, he would have been pushing his bike up,
yeah,
right?
He would. I think the first I think I mentioned it in the book, actually, the first incident of a rider actually climbing and pedalling all the way to the top of a bona fide mountain pass was in about the 1907 Tour de France. That was a Col de Port, I think, in the Chartreuse, yeah.
And had he got a special gear for doing that, or was he just hard as nails?
I think he was hard as nails. Yeah, and that certainly carried on, you know, for decades after that. I think riders were walking up. I mean, not the top riders. But it just shows, and we're really kind of at an impasse now with professional cycling, in that some of these mountain roads are just too straightforward, or they certainly don't represent the challenge that they used to represent. And consequently, the major tour organisers in particular have lapsed into this sort of desperate scramble for ever harder, ever steeper climbs. And it doesn't always make for a better spectacle. I think I talked to the former Tour de France winner Carlos Sastre about that in the entry on the Bola del Mundo in the book.
There seems to be this competition, as you say, between race organisers, and it's generally at the lower level of races than the Grand Tours that these climbs will first appear, and then they'll sort of work their way up, and there is accompanied by various boosters, you know, I don't know whether it's local cycling enthusiasts or local tourist board who want to try and get their hill in the Giro d'Italia or the Tour de France. But it's like almost watching riders work their way up through the ranks. You see climbs sort of work their way up through the ranks. Is that just because it's easier to put on a race up an unknown climb if it's a smaller race, and they have to sort of prove themselves to then get noticed by the Tour de France or the Giro d'Italia or Vuelta?
Yeah, I mean, very often, Jack, it's logistics that are the obstacle. There are various examples of climbs being proven to be very, very spectacular and gleaning a lot of publicity in smaller races, and then not making the grade because there isn't enough space at the finish, etc. There's one that I wanted to include in the book, the Punta Velena, which is as hard as pretty much anything in the book, in Italy, that was in the Giro del Trentino a couple of years ago, and couldn't. I spoke to the Giro d'Italia organiser. They would love to have it in, they simply can't because there's not enough room, it's too narrow. So yeah, that tends to be the case. I mean, often they are publicity stunts more than anything else, and you know, races have disappeared at an alarming rate over the past two or three years in particularly Spain and Italy, and I think this is a gimmick increasingly being used by small race organisers as well to gain some attention and gain some sponsorship.
A crazy climb.
Exactly, yeah.
What determines how a climb becomes legendary?
I think it's an assortment of factors. You know, I talked about the different criteria that we applied to selecting climbs in this book. I mean, it would have been easy just to pick 50 very beautiful climbs, 50 very extreme climbs, or 50 completely undiscovered climbs. But from my point of view, there had to be a great story there, or some kind of story, and they had to be diverse stories as well. It couldn't all be stories about, you know, the tragedies that occurred when they were building the road, which is, you know, happened in a lot of places in Europe when they were building some of these roads. Consequently, you know, I was able to find stories about UFO sightings and serial killer bears and extraordinary exploits that took place in major races. But you know, in terms of what climbs kind of do manage to impregnate themselves in, like, the popular psyche, it's quite a nebulous question, really. I think often it is to do with what happens there in major races. I mean, certainly from cyclists' point of view, that's certainly the case of races like of climbs like the Ventoux, the Tourmalet, the Galibier. But sometimes it is to do with the amount of publicity they're given in the run-up to the race. The Tourmalet, I think, a huge factor in the Tourmalet's favour was the hype surrounding, even in 1910, before they went up there. You know, there was a lot of talk about it before that first Tour de France up there, and that created a momentum then, which led to the Tour going back again and again and again, and it becoming more and more famous.
Where do you see this quest for more, newer, harder, higher, steeper, more difficult, more environmentally damaging climbs to be included in big races? Where's that going to go? How's that going to play out?
It seems, because the sport is still growing in all places, obviously the more famous climbs are getting so busy now that they may be able to branch out. But as you said, the logistics of finding a way a race can actually get to these climbs is a difficult thing in the first place. So I think they've been searching for, you know, 100 years or so or longer, because you're always looking for that new thing to make things a bit more interesting for a race and something that hasn't been done before. So they will always find a new climb.
Not running out of climbs.
No, certainly not, Jack. And a question I found myself asking several times when I was writing the book was how far we might be from a race organiser custom building a climb.
That's interesting.
And that is almost already happening with climbs like the Bola del Mundo in Spain. That there is
not custom building the mountain, but the road up.
Obviously, yeah.
No, you'd have to go to Dubai for that.
Well, you could, and there's also been talk about that for the World Championships in 2016.
I wouldn't put it past them.
They will build a hill, but yeah, to custom build a road up a climb, it kind of has happened with the Bola del Mundo in Spain. There was a track, a concrete path, basically. To a ski resort, and it was sort of amended and kind of equipped for a major race, and it happened at Plan de Coronas for the Giro d'Italia, another ski resort. There was some semblance of a track there, but
the Bola del Mundo, that climb though, the concrete, because it wasn't tarmac,
yeah,
it was
just concrete slabs,
and it was literally falling off the mountainside. You could see it didn't set, so it was actually slipping from the mountain itself because it was so steep. It was a crazy climb that we went up, and I nearly fell down that mountain because we got stuck up there at night as well. So.
I mean, is there any part of you that regrets what's happening? Do you see it as the urbanisation of wild places?
That's a worry in itself because a lot of these mountains are nature reserves in their own right, and with more people going up there, you're going to have a big environmental impact on the situation. Although saying that, there's always a man-made element there anyway. You've got the road going up there. People wouldn't be going without the road being there on a bike, that is, anyway.
Although if it's a track that then gets surfaced for a race and then gets the tourist kiosk at the top where you can get your Chris Froome keyring, you know, and your Panino, it's sort of... It's creep, isn't it? Once you put the tarmac down, then you know you unleash the world of advanced industrial capitalism to the mountain.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, absolutely. Although this has been happening, roads have been built in the mountains for centuries, and tarmac roads have been built for over a century. So it has been happening for a long time, and. Yeah, you can see it as regrettable, but you can also see it as offering great opportunities. The other thing is that I think bike technology has played a major role in making some of these very, very inaccessible places more accessible and perhaps too easy, some of these climbs too easy to conquer. And that is why the race organisers are increasingly looking for steeper and steeper climbs, but even they are not...
Was that because people are riding lower and lower gears?
Yeah, and bikes are...
Becoming lighter.
And that is one of the problems with the spectacle of racing the mountains in major tours. I think the major tour organisers, well, all professional race organisers, have assumed in the past few years that ever harder climbs will make for an ever more spectacular race. But that's not necessarily the case. Often you get quite a sterile race on those very difficult climbs because although... Everyone can kind of get up with the technology that they have now on the very light bikes, very low gears. It's very, very difficult to create time gaps.
And is that because of aerodynamics? That the faster you are able to go, the more aerodynamics comes into it, therefore the more drafting is an issue, whereas...
I'm not sure it's to do with aerodynamics on those very steep climbs. It's more, it would probably take a more scientifically minded and more intelligent person than me to explain. But I think it's a psychological factor that the riders are scared of these mountains. And consequently, if they come at the end of races, which they often do now, the race finishes at altitude at the end of one of these very steep climbs. No one will make their move before the very, very end of these climbs. And so consequently, we see the spectacle condensed into the last kilometre or so of these very, very steep uphill finishes. And consequently, the time gaps are not very big. Also, it seems to be more difficult when everyone is riding in a very, very tiny gear to prolong a huge effort, which will create a big time gap.
Unless you're Chris Froome with a washing machine,
well, exactly,
spin
yeah.
gear.
Yeah.
So you did speak to a number of pro riders asking for their favourites. Do you get the sense that they relish these places and take as much interest in them as the rest of us do from a sort of landscape perspective and a culture and a traditions perspective? Mm-hmm. Or is it just another road for them in a race?
I think because a lot of these riders do live out and train around these mountains, they either went there for a reason or because, you know, they love the areas or because of through practicalities. But by cycling up and down them non-stop, they become part of their life. They become, you know, they'll know every little bend, every little contour on the road, probably any crack in the tarmac, because they do it over and over again.
I mean, I think it varies a lot, Jack, that some I found to be incredibly blasé and not all that interested, and others, it tends to be mountain climbers. So someone like the Italian Gilberto Simoni, who's retired now, but he grew up in the mountains, made his name as a mountain climber. He was an encyclopedia about certainly climbs in his area. He could have talked to me for hours and hours about that. Whereas others see these climbs as tarmac roads, and which impart great pain and not much beyond that, and they don't really process and remember the names of places they've been to in races, and they struggle to tell you which is more beautiful, which is even sometimes which is more difficult than, you know, one climb or another. The greatest resource by far for me was these communities, and they seem to be particularly strong in Italy and Spain. They call themselves Salitormani in Italy, which is literally maniacs of climbing, and they exchange vast quantities of information on particularly internet forums, and there are some outstanding websites. There's an outstanding German website called Quelldic, .de and altimetrias.net in Spain, and, you know, I think Pete, we both owe those websites, and you know, the people exchanging information on there a lot in terms of, you know, what we were able to do with mountain hire.
And you have got one British mountain in Scotland. Is that a cracker? I've not ridden that.
It's definitely one of my favourites. There are half a dozen or so of my favourites, but that one stands out. It was the penultimate climb that I did before I finished shooting the book. We both went separately. Daniel went a week before I did. I'm not sure if you had the same weather when I...
No, it was a deluge, which was
fantastic. How do you pronounce it? Balakhnaba?
I think so, yeah.
Balakhnaba, yeah, I think, but please don't quote me on
that. Write in, Scottish listeners, with exactly. A correct pronunciation.
But it was the most spectacular scenery I've ever... It's coined as one of the toughest climbs in the British Isles. Not the highest, I don't think, but I think between 11% and 30%...
18
or something. Yeah. In terms of the scenery, when I turned up there, the sunset was just outstanding. The purple hues it's really hard for me to explain in words, because I was just there on my own, and it was tranquil. There was nobody. There was one person that came past me within about 4 hours, and it just sort of summed up the whole experience of doing the book. And It made my job so much more easy to do that, and it was just nice to be able to sit there, and I got my job done within a few hours, and I could just enjoy it for the rest of it, really. So.
I mean, the photographs are absolutely spectacular. How do you go about photographing landscapes like this and capturing them all? Because it's so difficult. You've mentioned already the difficult weather conditions and having to go repeatedly, but you presumably have to go at difficult times of day, the beginning and the end of the day, because at midday... It's all going to be sort of black and white, isn't it?
Well, yeah, although there's an argument to say, because we've got 50 climbs there, so I wanted to try and vary the lighting situation. So on some occasions I did have the sun directly above my head, and but you can work with that, try and get some really harsh shadows on the mountainsides, and you can shoot into the sun and get some amazing effects. So... yeah, the golden hour at the end of the day, fantastic. You know, there were a few, probably half a dozen mountains that I did shoot in that period, and at the beginning of the day as well. And you do get lovely soft light, long shadows, and it does really make the landscape look beautiful. But it was trying to get the character of the mountain itself. So I'd be in the car going up and down, round and round circles, and you wanted to try and find something that would sum up the mountain to start off with, which would probably be the opener or something similar, and then I'll be waiting for the light to be in a certain situation, and depending on logistics, you know, sometimes we only had a couple of days, or maybe in some cases we only had a couple of hours to shoot it, so there are many factors that would be involved in it, but yeah, I wouldn't leave the mountain until I got the shot, basically. So if I had to go back, I had to go back.
So let's talk about summer 2014. I don't know if you'll be researching the sequel to the sequel, but a lot of people will be wanting to go on their summer holidays. And of course, as we head into the dark months of winter, that's the time when we start flicking through guidebooks and figuring out where we might go. That seems to me to be a great reason to buy this book, is because it's got a ton of ideas about places you might go that you don't know about, that have got great cycling in, and particularly towards the end where they just seem to get more and more extreme, longer and higher and more exciting. Do you want to suggest a few places that people might think of basing themselves for a cycling holiday, and not for a cycle sport holiday, but for a cycling in the mountains and just experiencing what it's like to be riding at altitude?
Yeah, this was another thing that we wanted to do with it, but we wanted to provide groups, in some cases little groupings of mountains, and sometimes we've even included three in the same entry, precisely for that reason, Jack. And also, we've also given alternative routes in a lot of cases, so that there is a main climb, but there are detours off left and right, with equally spectacular climbs that people can go and do. I would say, there are certain kind of cult or very popular destinations in the Alps, like Jean de Maurienne, where you can do the Galibier one side, or you can do the Telegraph, the Madeleine. I would suggest somewhere different and say, for instance, the Chartreuse Trilogy, which is between Grenoble and Chambéry, just on the edge of the Alps. That would be a good alternative. The Ancares in Spain, you can do some absolutely extraordinary climbs there. Pretty difficult, though, I'm afraid. And
well, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, and then a sort of alternative to the very, very famous climbs, but also very difficult in the Southern Alps, I would say the Cayaux Alos Champ trilogy that we feature in the book, which is 3,000-plus-metre climbs. Very, very difficult again, but you'll barely see a car, and for my money, more beautiful and probably more challenging than something like the Galibier in Alpe d'Huez in further north in the Alps.
Yeah, just because the Tour de France or the Giro d'Italia or whatever can't go there doesn't mean it's not hard and difficult and beautiful, exactly. Does it? Yeah. I mean, they have their own logistical problems that doesn't affect us holiday makers. It seems to me that Austria and Switzerland, get a bit of not much of rubber the green because they don't have such a big grand tour. We don't get their mountains showcased as much, and I was surprised. I mean, I was thinking I just want to go to Switzerland on holiday now. Beautiful.
Yeah, the Swiss, I mean, for my money, the three sort of back-to-back, it was actually a loop of passes, the Grimsel or the Furka and the Susten. I don't think there's any equal in Europe in terms of I'm sure a road engineer would tell you this as well, how they're built and also the landscapes. They are
breathtaking. Yeah, each one in their own right. They were going to be separate climbs in the book, but we decided to sort of squish them together to make space for others. But it was a bit of a
shame. Could you do the whole lot in a day? Would that be a challenge?
After you, Jack.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you could, absolutely. Yeah, but you'd have to be pretty fit. But and on Austria, feel like we perhaps slightly neglected Austria. We've done two in Austria, but there's a huge playground of fantastic, remote, extraordinarily beautiful climbs. And like you say, they don't get the publicity and they don't get the attention that the climbs of the Tour and the Giro do, because there aren't really major races in Austria.
It's the tip of the iceberg. We've done 100 now, and as you said before, there are so many more hundreds to look at. Every time we were going to a mountain pass that we were going to feature, we were going over other passes which we were looking around and going, hold on a minute, we should be doing this.
And sometimes
we?
Changing our plans.
We did that very much in the Pyrenees, close to the Tourmalet and all the famous obisques. You've got the Marie Blanc, which, again, that is quite famous, to be fair, because it was in recent races, but we actually changed our mind at that point and decided, well, this is the one for us. And I can't remember which one hit the cutting room floor at that point. But it's such a difficult thing to try and work out which ones to include and which ones to drop, really.
So you've got plenty more for book number three?
Valley Low number three is.
I think we're a bit worn out after doing these two, to be fair. We need a little break first.
I just wanted to ask briefly about Strava, because that obviously in Britain is a big thing and in America as well. You talked about a couple of online communities that swap information. Is Strava being used in these climbs? Is Strava a useful tool for discovering interesting and undiscovered climbs?
Yeah, I think it is, Jack. I mean, I personally don't use it. I don't really ride that much anymore. But I think it obviously gives a different dimension to riding the mountains. It's obviously very, very popular, so you can't really argue with that. One thing I would say is that, again, it does slightly demystify some of these places. And, for instance, when we went to do the climbs and when I went to ride them, this is something I probably shouldn't admit, but sometimes I did them, well, very often I did them on a folding bike with trainers, wearing trainers and...
respect.
And a gym kit.
That's the spirit of 1879.
Without being too flippant about it,
did you have a strap break for when you came down the other side?
But again, this was one of the reasons I did this. The main one was convenience, but I actually found it quite liberating in the sense that I used to cycle a lot more seriously, and I would formally kind of shave my legs and get all kitted up and with my carbon bike, etc. But to do it on a folding bike in those conditions, I found that it enabled me not to make the comparisons between how good I used to be, not to make the comparisons with how fast I should be going, any kind of Strava time, etc., etc. It enabled me just to focus on the mountain. And, so it's each to their own, I think.
Daniel, welcome to cycle touring. It's taken you a little while to get here.
I'm not
here,
that old yet.
But, hey, steady on.
Easy.
Remember where you are. You're on the bike show on Resonance FM. So as well as the book, you've got some online goodies that people can look at. It's got some films, is it? I haven't actually managed to check this out, but I have heard that there are moving pictures online linked somehow to the book.
There's the Quirkus Eye app that you can download for free, I believe. And you literally scan in a page. There are about 10 designated climbs, I think. One including the Scottish climb, which I won't mention just in case I haven't pronounced it properly.
It's like the Scottish play, isn't it? The Scottish climb.
Exactly.
Similarly fifth.
You scan in the picture and it'll literally link you to some footage of the maybe a small snippet, maybe a minute or so of moving images as you're going to the summit, with some stats and gradient maps and things like that. So it's an interesting little extra that we've added in. It's not for every climb, but I videoed most of it, but yeah, it's worth a go if you can do it. It's free as well. So,
well, thank you, Daniel Freeb and Pete Godding, for coming in to talk about your new book, Mountain Hire, Europe's Extreme, Unforgettable and Undiscovered Cycle Climbs. It's published by Quercus, and at £25 is a very worthwhile investment for any bookshelf or coffee table. Thanks both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And let's play out. Well, I couldn't really resist this. You've been listening to The Bike Show here on Resonance FM. My name's Jack Thurston. Until next week, goodbye. Listen, baby. Ain't no mountain high enough, ain't no valley low.
Welcome back, podcast listeners. Thanks for sticking around. Now, if you live in London, or even if you don't, you may have noticed the Space for Cycling campaign that's emerged over the past couple of years, spearheaded by the London Cycling Campaign. It's a campaign which has emerged from a series of mass protest rides on Blackfriars Bridge, following plans to reorganise the bridge to the detriment of cyclists, continued with the Go Dutch campaign during the mayoral elections last year, and over this summer with a series of massive protest rides following deaths of cyclists on London streets. And it's not just in London. Space for Cycling is a campaigning message that's been seen on the streets of Birmingham and Manchester too. But what does Space for Cycling actually mean? Well, that's a question that people have been asking for a little while now. Most people assume that Space for Cycling means Dutch-style protected bike lanes. But there's a strong tradition of mistrust of separated bike lanes among British cycle campaigning organisations, including the London Cycling Campaign. And it's been a subject of some nuanced ambiguity over the last couple of years. But at this weekend's annual general meeting of the London Cycling Campaign, a series of motions were passed that sets out the detail and sets the compass for campaigns to come. I wasn't at the meeting, but I'm joined on a Skype line by someone who was. Bill Chidley, bike blogger, former bike messenger, and regular contributor to The Bike Show. Bill, did you get the feeling that policy was being made on Saturday morning?
It wasn't so much that policy was being made on Saturday morning. It was more that policies which have already been formulated in the policy forums of the LCC were enacted as official LCC policies. I mean, there's two things, really, which were quite important. One was that they want to campaign ward by ward in every single ward in Greater London, which is massive, and reach every single candidate. So that's around about potentially 7,000 candidates in the upcoming elections. And also there was a motion that was passed basically setting out the terms of space for cycling. You know, what is space for cycling? And the motion makes it pretty clear that space for cycling means protected space. So almost certainly protected by a curb, or planters possibly, or the funny armadillo things, the kind of little lumps in the road, but not, and this is pretty crucial if you're talking about London cycle infrastructure, not paint.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people being worried about just more blue paint or more green paint. But the motion sets out a criterion by which a road will have this protected space.
You know, it's passenger car units per day.
A passenger car unit is a car, or a bus counts for two, or a truck counts for two. Okay, so that's 2,000 cars a day. If that number of cars goes along the street, or if the average speed is more than 20 miles an hour, then that is cause for demanding protected bike lane on that street.
What the policy actually says is that you either reduce the volume and speed or put in high-quality protected cycle infrastructure.
And so presumably for streets that don't have that many motor vehicle movements or don't go very fast, then you don't need anything and you just leave it as it is.
I mean, you'd be looking for 20 miles an hour. So, I mean, one of the strengths of the election campaign strategy is that the borough groups aren't obliged to campaign for separated lanes. They can campaign for other things like safe routes to school, quiet zones, greenways, which I think that's another version of quiet ways, but I could be wrong, and livable town centres, which means, you know, taking cars out and making wider pavements, and so forth.
Right, but it does seem that space for cycling is the message that is getting the traction out there, really, isn't it?
Space for cycling is the headline of the campaign. And one of the things that they talked about from the platform in the AGM was how successful space for cycling has been in the sense that campaign groups from around the country are looking for help launching their own Space for Cycling campaign. And it's just, I think it's a very clever slogan because it's short, but it describes exactly what is wanted, whereas sort of cycle safe, you know, that can mean a lot of different things. You've got British Cycling's version of that, which is cycle proofing, which I've said on my blog is a load of nonsense, I think. But yeah, Space for Cycling is, yeah, it describes exactly what is wanted.
I mean, it's basically spaces fit for cycling, whether they're quiet streets where it's a pleasure to ride a bike, or a busy street where you need your own designated space, like you get in Copenhagen or the Netherlands. But it's still controversial, isn't it? And there was some debate over whether this motion should be agreed. Do you want to describe where the opposition was coming from and why?
I think there was some dissension from it. I kind of experienced that in the workshop later. But I wouldn't say it was organised or it coalesced necessarily.
It's just one or two people.
It's just one or two people saying we don't need this.
And who are these? These are the vehicular cyclists.
So-called. I think they're more people whose starting point is we'll never get it. So we should be practical and just ask for what we can get, which is the sort of rubbish that we've got now.
Right.
So, you know, it's more a question. Yeah, I mean, it's so-called pragmatism. And then there are some people who think that we belong in the traffic, which, you know, I mean, you or I are quite happy to cycle around London in the traffic. You know, I can, you know, certain times I can actually enjoy it. But the whole point is you can get grandmothers and small children on bikes. You know, because when I took my mum cycling, she's, what, 72. And when we were on the main roads, it was just I was just terrified, really terrified. That's who those cycling facilities are aimed at. They're not aimed at us, the competent and experienced cyclists. They're aimed at people who are vulnerable, so children and the elderly, just everyone, really.
And there's a line of argument that traditionally comes out, is that if those people who are vulnerable just became a bit more competent, they'd be all right. If they just became a bit more like us, they'd be all right and they could cycle in the way that we're happy to. Well, I wouldn't say, I put in a caveat, I'm not sure that I'm always happy to be, you know, with a cement mixer on one side of me and a red bus on the other. But, you know, I can generally manage, so far, so good. But the idea that increasing people's level of skill and speed will allow them to cycle in the road with all the motor traffic. I mean, that's still a view that you hear.
It is true to an extent. There's no reason why you couldn't learn to cycle from, you know, because I did it. You know, I was cycling in the traffic from when I was very small. But the point is not so much, you know, whether it's safe, you know, how relatively safe cycling is, but it's more about why are cycling now. And the reason, overwhelmingly, the reason that people give why they don't cycle is because it's scary and it's hard. You know, the hard bit we can't do anything about, but the scary bit we can address with sort of separation and making the streets a bit more civilized.
It does seem to me that this campaign has come a long way from where cycle campaigning was 10 or 15 years ago, when it was all about showers at work and bike racks in the street, and those were the sort of the issues that were most salient in campaigns. Let's talk a little bit about the London Cycling Campaign as an organisation and the challenges it faces. We've both had our ups and downs with the LCC. I'm currently in an up phase. I'm very happy with what they're doing, and I've really noticed the difference that the new, well, not so new anymore, but the chief exec, Ashok Sinha, has made a huge difference to the organisation. It's become a lot slicker, hasn't it?
Yes.
Which has ruffled a few feathers. And there was another motion on the AGM about whether the LCC was courting too much corporate cash money and whether that was a bad thing for a grassroots organisation to do. And carrying adverts and reviews of £500 cycling jackets in its members' magazine, and whether that was departing from the, you know, the origins of the LCC, which are in the 1970s, Friends of the Earth sort of make do and mend style of campaigning. Is that the reality these days of campaigning organisations, that they have to reach a certain level of income to be able to be effective, and the only way to do that is either to have a load of members or to get some rich members who will give you more than the you know, the membership due of whatever it is, 40 quid a year.
I thought that that motion was just ridiculous, and I voted against it and filibustered it and did everything I could to try and stop it from passing. You know, one of the reasons I did that was because campaigning organisation runs on money. You need money. And what they're planning to do next year is going to be really, really expensive. The finance guy who was there said that if they took away the sponsorship and other revenue streams and relied on membership alone, they would need to treble the membership. So that gives you an idea of how important financially the sponsors are. And then, you know, you look at what the objections were and it's like, oh, have you never read a cycle magazine? Yeah, the guy who proposed it looked like a 70s cyclist. And, you know, the current leadership of the LCC is young, which, you know, where most cycle campaigners are not. I mean, most cycle campaigners are older than me, and I'm not particularly young. Yeah, the current leadership is basically quite young, quite youthful, professional-looking, smartly turned out, and don't really look like green activists or particularly look like cyclists, or, you know, whatever a cyclist looks like. But they don't look like cyclists. I mean, Mustafa Arif, I was very, very impressed by it. I mean, Ashok as well, but Mustafa Arif, I was very, very impressed by it. Spoke really well, came across very professionally, very persuasive, quite calm, which was quite important as well. So,
and we're not talking about the LCC being funded by arms dealers, are we? It's like Brompton,
Raffles, I don't know.
You know, a few law companies that maybe work with personal injury and, you know, yeah. This is the way that organisations have to go. And I guess the LCC's critics, some of the LCC's critics, such as you and me, have criticised them for taking a little bit too much of being a little bit too reliant on money from the government in the form of Transport for London, and therefore not being able to criticise as much as they should the authorities. And I think it's really important that campaigning organisations are able to speak with a strong and powerful voice to government without cowering and worrying that their grant might get cut next year if they say something unkind to the mayor. I mean, that's surely the real problem. And that was the problem, I think, that the LCC had a few years ago when it was very reliant on grant funding.
Yeah, I mean, Kane was very good at co-opting them. I mean, he did very much co-opt them. I mean, they still get quite a bit of money from TfL, and that was raised at the meeting as well. And they said that basically when they're looking to criticise things that TfL does, they go after the political leadership as opposed to the civil servants, because it's the political leadership, which means the mayor and the assembly members who are accountable to the public. So there is still a tension there, I think. And it'll be interesting to see how that pans out in the election next year. And I think that's part of the reason why they decided to go for all 7,000 candidates, is so that they can't be accused of being partisan. And therefore, you know, there's less risk of, you know, whichever party they've annoyed the most getting in and instantly cutting their budget. You know, it's so ambitious, this plan.
Yeah, I mean, you say that, Bill, but if the London Cycling Campaign has got 12,000 members, I don't know how evenly they're distributed across the Greater London electoral map, but I see this, we're going to campaign in every ward, as actually a really good way of empowering the membership and saying, we need you as a member to approach your candidates in your ward as just a member, not as an official. And so they're not going to have to hire extra people. They're just, I mean, approaching a candidate simply means getting in touch with them, having a short meeting, if possible, and giving them a couple of pointers of what you want. And generally, if you're already out there cycling and you're a member of the London Cycling Campaign, you probably know a few things in your neck of the woods that you'd like to see improved. So I think it's a really positive step to have taken, because I think the danger with some of these organisations that you see evolving into very top-heavy campaigning organisations is that they really just focus on, you know, the highest level of government, and they have a very professional campaigning outfit that just speaks to, you know, whoever's going to be mayor and tries to win them over, rather than saying, you know, we're going to empower and trust our members to go out and do the job for us. That's just my interpretation. When I saw that, I thought that was, you know, that was a really good thing to do, because I know that they can't do it with their staff. So that basically means they're going to be relying on volunteer labour.
I was in the AGM, and at one point they were like, you know, who's here from? And there was big holes. So like Barking, there was no one from Barking, there's no one from Redbridge there. You know, and Barking and Redbridge, I mean, like Hackney, there's already lots of stuff happening. Redbridge and Barking probably need more attention from activists than Hackney does.
Yeah, I mean, it's all self-fulfilling, isn't it, that the more hostile a borough is to cycling, the fewer people will ride bikes, therefore the fewer will be members of the London Cycling Campaign. So it's a kind of vicious circle. And I think this is the problem that is faced by a lot of cycling campaigns in towns and cities throughout the country. You know, there aren't enough people riding because it's so difficult to ride that you don't have enough people for a cycling campaign, and therefore you're stuck.
You know, that's where the national campaigning is kind of needed. And, you know, I don't think the London Cycling Campaign can lead the national campaigns, but
can lead by example.
You can lead by example. I mean, places like Greater Manchester, they're kind of looking to what's happening in London. And, you know, because basically if we can get cycling infrastructure put in London, then everywhere else in the country can go, well, they've done it in London. I mean, just about every single objection will be blown out of the water, apart from obviously money. But, you know, the general ones, you know, there isn't enough room. I mean, in Manchester, there's plenty of room. Just off the top of my head. Manchester, there's plenty of room. Birmingham, same thing. The other campaigns around the country, I think, will be really encouraged by what's happening in London and envious and hopefully wishing to copy it.
Yeah, well, that's a subject that we're going to be returning to in future episodes of The Bike Show. Bill, thanks for joining us, and I'm sure we'll reconnect again to hear more about how Space for Cycling is getting on.
Thanks again, Jack.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. It's www.resonancefm.com.